There are increasing economic pressures to, if not be monolingual, at least to function in the dominant language in a way that allows you to make a living.
So there are strong economic reasons why people just stop using their mother tongue.
I think there are, and it's about opportunity too as well. I mean, even if you're speaking, you know, your mother tongue at home, most of us spend most of our days working and most of our time at home sleeping. So that's limited opportunities to use a language. Unless we've got active domains of language use, then inevitably it's going to be difficult.
And are more and more languages becoming extinct as time goes on?
They are indeed. I think we've had a few statistics thrown around at this meeting so far. A language disappearing every 2 weeks or even less.
That's an extraordinary thought, isn't it? Every 2 weeks or less?
It is extraordinary. But when you think about how many languages we have, like something like 6,000 on the planet, and most of them being indigenous languages, because they are such a small language groups we're talking about, maybe it's not that surprising.
What's the downside of these languages disappearing in what seems like a sort of fairly irresistible process?
There's a very real argument that if a person or if a people do not have a language, then they are not a distinct people. That's something that's been brought up by especially some of my South American colleagues at this very meeting. So identity and language go together. And secondly, a language carries with it not just words, but a whole worldview. A people's cultural heritage and their collective memory of their ancestors is all carried within a language. We have these untranslatables in every language.
What kind of responsibility does the UN have in all of this? And what would you like the UN to be doing more of to help to save some of these dying languages?
The UN has formulated the document that we all talk about today, you know, the rights of indigenous people. It's good to have documents come out of the UN to put pressure on governments to do things at a local level. But that's a bit of a difficult path to tread. And then you've got grassroots implementation as well, where you have, say, the Australian government saying, yes, let's teach Aboriginal languages in schools, and then you have school principals laying off Aboriginal language teachers because they don't see the sense in doing so.
So can the UN apply anything more than just moral pressure, really?
I think it's multi-level. One of my colleagues in the meeting just now has published a report essentially highlighting the personal responsibility that carriers of a language or inheritors of a language have to maintain their own languages. They've got to get political and they've got to get proactive. So that's that real grassroots level, just the personal level.
What's your favourite phrase from your own endangered language?
My favourite phrase is quap it quap, which is a very simple phrase and it just means really, really good. Nyungara language, my mother's language, is one of the most onomatopoeic languages you're likely to find. Extremely poetic. That's one of the things that I love about the language is that, especially when you're looking at songs, there's so much intellectual rigour, so much artistry that goes into creating these oral texts that it really makes me proud. There's something you can't quite put your finger on about languages as well, which sort of, not trying to get all new agey or something, but something that's almost spiritual about languages. Quite often, in Australia particularly, Aboriginal people will talk about country being happy when language is spoken or when language is sung. I'm quite a pragmatic person, but I am a Nyungara person as well, so I try to be in tune with things outside the academic world, and I've seen responses to language in country, which science can't explain, but that idea of country being happy that language is spoken, that goes some way to explaining it.